I just want to start right in saying thank you, Rick, for being here. Rick has come from the West Coast, or actually he's already on the East Coast, but it's not a small deal to come into town. And Rick and I have been kind of hatching this for a while. We've been really excited because this is a little different, as those of you know that have come to our events here, to have this kind of a workshop. So it's going to be an interesting unfolding for the day. If I had to say in a broad way, perhaps, what it's about, really the intention is the awakening of the heart. And we'll be drawing on, Rick will bringing in some of the science that is so fascinating and profound at really guiding us in this process. And of course, there'll be the Dharma teachings and practices. So that's the overview. So I just want to say a little bit about Rick, who we've now known each other for 6 years, maybe, something like that. Rick is a clinical psychologist, and he's, in addition to being a psychologist, is a writer, and he wrote a book on taking care of mothers, which is really hasn't been written, and has just completed another book, Buddha's Brain, which has a lot of what you're going to be hearing about today. And he travels around now doing more and more of these kind of workshops of bringing together Buddhist teachings with the science. So it's very an alive part of things for him. Just to say that this theme today of bringing together the science and the Dharma is really going to be focused on our relationships with each other, and we'll be inviting you, we'll be speaking some, we'll be leading meditations, we'll be having a chance for sharing. But to say that it's always edgy when we're doing what we call relational meditations. And by edgy, I mean we're much more familiar with the instructions, sit down, close your eyes, go inside, and not so familiar with the instructions of be present, and let's explore being with each other in that presence. And so just to know that our intention is to have as much of a sense of safety and ease in that adventure of exploring what it means to do relational practice with each other. Historically, in the teachings and the practices, the emphasis has been somewhat solo. I remember one of my favorite in Tricycle, they had a Buddhist personals, and it said, tall, dark, handsome Buddhist looking for himself. So it's been really like this. So this is really an enlarging of it. One of my favorite stories is of a Sufi master who was really beloved by many, and people would go to his favorite coffee house, where he was always surrounded by students, and they were really drawn to his compassion, his radiance. And many would ask him, how'd you become so holy? And his response was, well, I know what is in the Quran. And finally, one day, some pretty crazy guy kind of belligerently said, so, what is it? What's in the Quran? And the master responded, in the Quran there are two pressed flowers and a letter from my friend Abdullah. This spiritual life, you know, in any tradition is as much about how awake we are and caring we are with each other as it is about any degree of seeing emptiness or what we call inner freedom. That's the expression of the freedom. Love is the expression of freedom. I'm really excited that we get to explore that in these different dimensions, and I wanted to ask Rick for you to share a little bit about what got you so interested in the science element, plus anything else you'd like to say about the day?
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and I want to thank you for the welcome to be here, and I really appreciate it. I think what got me interested in this is probably what gets most of us interested in any kind of personal growth. suffering. As a fairly miserable young person, I was just swept away by the mystery of what in the world is going on in the mind, right? And I think that's kind of where we start. We have no idea. It just stuff comes and goes. We react to different people in different ways. We want to get some kind of handle on what's happening, and it's like, what is up? And then we come across things like, for me, the Dharma. I came across that when I was very young, 1974, and as well as psychology. And that seemed to offer a lot about what is up, right? And what can we do to sort of help it go better for ourselves and for other people? And then recently, probably about in the last 10 years, there's just been a kind of incredible wildfire of coming together of the spark and the fuel of science and contemplative practice in the West. And those two coming together are really illuminating about what is up. Because, as we'll talk later, absent a transcendental principle, whatever's going on in your mind is what's going on in your brain. So by understanding what's going on in your brain, or more broadly, your nervous system, and even broadly, the whole world, but by really what's understanding what's going on in your brain, it gives you a lot of clarity about what's up and how to help it go better. So that is particularly my interest. I mean, I have a fascination with it intellectually. It's just an awe, you know. On my laptop, my screensaver is this big galaxy swallowing another galaxy. Like, that kind of stuff just trips me out. But the way the brain works and the mind works also is full of awe. But beyond the awe part, there's the sense of usefulness. What can we actually do with our own mind to shape our brain to benefit our mind and therefore our heart, our whole being, and every other being we touch? I mean, that's what really interests me a lot. And if I have an excess of enthusiasm about it. So forgive me if my enthusiasm just kind of like spills out, you know, like gets you muddy with enthusiasm or something. But anyway, that's what brought me to this a lot. So I really want to offer that to you, that sense that by knowing more about this, not like becoming a brain scientist, but just a few practical things, wow, you can make such a difference inside your own head, which will really completely benefit your heart and your heart with other people. So that's our focus today.
And I love your enthusiasm. It gets me revved. You know, when you think of what is the value of understanding the science, I mean, for me, there are two things that really stand out. And one is that the more I understand the conditioning, and Rick's going to be describing really the evolution of how it is that we are the way we are, the less we take it personally. When you get how it is, how we're wired, it just does not feel like such a stamp of personal wrongness in some way. So that's one thing, is that it actually frees us to understand. The second is that perhaps the main teaching in the science is that by paying attention, by training your mind to pay attention, you can radically transform your inner experience. This is the reason that people are absolutely flocking now to meditation in every part of the culture, because there's like this recognition. We've got this capacity. And, you know, Rick will talk about neuroplasticity in the mind. We've got this capacity to alter our experience, to awaken our mind, to free our hearts by paying attention. So that's kind of cool. It gives us a real sense of confidence and possibility. And that maybe to say that as we deepen our attention, what becomes clear is that love matters. The more we become present, the more we learn to train our attention, that's what we realize. I remember, I think it was last year, coming upon a brief story about the poet Hafiz, and a man had had what he thought was a profoundly enlightening spiritual experience, vision of God and an experience of merging with light and so on. And he asked Hafiz, was it real? And so Hafiz asked him, well, do you have any goats? And the guy said, mm-hmm. Do you have a wife? Mm-hmm. Do you have children, siblings, parents, friends? You know, asked all these questions. And his response was, the realness of the sacred shows itself through the kindness you express with each being of your life. In Buddhism, there's considered to be three expressions or refuges or gateways or jewels that we can't separate. And it's the jewel of the awareness itself, that which we are. It's the jewel of the Dharma, of the different teachings and truths and ways of being present. And it's the jewel of what's right here, which is, even if we have the idea of sitting and being a separate entity, there is a field of relatedness that we absolutely belong to, and that as we wake up, our freedom is realizing that. There's a shift from this fixation on me to this sense of this belonging, which is home. It's what really we cherish. And for those of you that have been with me before, I frequently use the expression that our sickness is homesickness. Remember that? And that in this path of waking up, it's really coming home to this heart, to this kindness, to this presence. So we'll begin the day with a sitting, a short sitting, because it's really the meditation that trains us to come home, to be here. And I see you're all kind of Pavlovian reflex. Okay, let's... It's good, it's good. It's a skillful thing. So I'm going to just say a couple of words to frame the meditation. We have different ones of us at different kind of levels of experience. There are so many different ways people understand meditation, different ideas of what it is. And I'd like to, for what I find to be the most elegant way of saying it, is that you might consider two categories, and one of them are all the attentional strategies, the ways of guiding our mind to arrive here. They're all the what are called skillful means that create a conducive atmosphere for natural presence. Okay, so there's all the skillful means, and then there's the presence itself, which is not contrived. And I like to emphasize that because our real freedom, any true wisdom, freedom, liberation, arises out of fully inhabiting natural presence. So if we're hooked on all the skillful means, the ways of getting there, we will not recognize that our very nature is presence. We'll always be trying to manipulate. And yet there's an incredible power, and there's a beauty to learning with a light touch how to direct the mind to then be able to let go into natural presence. Okay, so skillful means, all the ways of arriving, and then the presence itself. I hope that makes sense, and if you have questions, we can explore them in time. So in this particular sitting, you're going to hear some guidance that are different ways that you can explore in arriving. And then the last part will be just resting in presence. As a way of beginning, as many of you have, we find a way of sitting that supports this kind of homecoming. Maybe if I had to say what the pointers are for sitting, it's that combination of some quality of tall, upright, so there's supporting that alertness, that awakeness that's intrinsic to presence. So just sense if you're sitting tall, and sometimes that just means that the back has some level of being straight without being stiff. The chin is slightly tucked. Shoulders are down. So they're sitting upright. And then the other quality of posture is relaxing. So once you sense that you have a balance, you know, that you're not leaning forward or back to the sides, that there's some alignment, that gravity's doing its thing. Then really sense, okay, right here, what your intention is for these next minutes. And when I say intention, to open any sitting or any day or the beginning of a life activity with sensing what matters to you. There's a saying that the most important thing is remembering the most important thing. So what's most important for these next few minutes of sitting? It might be a quality of presence, a quality of heart, a quality of mind. It might be that these few minutes in some way serve really relaxing, touching peace, opening your heart. Sometimes in setting an intention, just to mentally whisper your inner prayer or your aspiration can open up the quality of sincerity, which really is what animates intention. Just to feel sincere right now. And once you've sensed in your heart what matters, then take some moments to give yourself the gift of relaxing just a little bit more. It's such a profound part of arriving right here. You might take a few full breaths, some very conscious, long, deep breaths, so that as you inhale, you fill the lungs completely. Maybe even hold for a moment. And then just feel the letting go with the out-breath. Feel it. That's it, good. Inhaling again, deep, full in-breath. And with the out-breath, maybe a softening, releasing, letting go. And once again, exhaling, letting go after the breath in. That's it. So that even as the breath is natural and relaxed again, you can maybe scan through the body and sense if there's any places of habitual holding. I like to form a slight smile at the mouth and relax the jaw. It invites a whole bodily sense of relaxing fight flight and just opening to what's here. And let the shoulders down, relaxing back and down. Just feeling from the inside the life that's there. So if there's tangles in the shoulders, see if they can naturally loosen and soften. Let the hands rest in a really easy and effortless way. And notice what happens if you feel the hands from the inside. And just soften. Can you detect the life that's in there? You know, the tingling and the vibrating. Let the chest be open. You might soften the belly. And letting the attention move down through the body, letting go through the legs. So you can feel the feet too from the inside, just loosening, feeling the life there. Feeling this aliveness, this presence right here, you might bring to mind as much a sense of safety in this presence as you can. It might be that intuition of just really being in a protected setting amongst people that, like yourself, care about waking up the heart. An invitation to yourself to really feel a sense of it's okay right here. That you can relax, vigilance, and just permission to bring your attention inward, to come home a bit more. As part of this arriving, you might sense and bring to mind some positive feelings. Perhaps a sense of the aliveness that you can feel right here. Perhaps a sense of background peacefulness. Or it might be something you're just appreciative of in your life right now. Just bringing to mind someone that you love or some beauty, some source of happiness. And sensing the felt sense of that. So that you're just including in a more whole way your life experience. And just noticing the arriving that's already occurring since you've been here, that the benefits of just this kind of attending, supporting you and nurturing, opening a bit. And as a way of just gently collecting the mind and settling even more, you might let the inflow and outflow of your breath be in the foreground. Sensing the possibility of relaxing with the breath. So that as it comes in, there's an opening to receive, kind of a loosening, a softening. And as it goes out, more letting go. Enjoying a sense of resting with the breath. A kind of interest in what does it actually feel like? Letting your awareness be right where the breath is, perhaps the inflow, outflow at the nostrils. Or maybe if you feel it more predominantly as a rising, falling in the chest. So from the beginning to the ending of each breath and the space between, an intimate kind of attention. It's natural that the mind would drift. So when you notice thinking, being in that trance of future, past, commentary, just to pause, re-relax, arriving right here again, perhaps noticing the next inflow or outflow of the breath. Letting that be a kind of home base. You might widen the attention to notice how each of the senses can be open and awake. Feeling the breath, but also feeling the whole field of sensations in the body. Aware of the sounds that are here, listening. Even if your eyes are closed, you might sense that dappling of light and darkness. Listening to, feeling, sensing the whole moment right now. And beyond the sensations and sounds that are in the foreground, the breath, sensing the presence that's here. Can you sense your own presence? The silence that's listening. This awake space of awareness that includes all experience. For this last part of our sitting, just to rest in this natural presence. Recognizing and allowing the changing experience moment to moment.
Would you like to share what you experienced in the meditation? Maybe a few people? Actually, I I'm sympathetic to the desire not to go into words. Well, actually, maybe I'll just... Oh, yeah, you? Perfect, thank you.
Really scary and overwhelming and really big at moments. So,
could you say more what you found scary or overwhelming or big?
I think just losing self.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Losing sense of self or I or a congealed center.
Yeah. And then I was able to ground in something else, but there was a time of just real scariness.
Yeah. Did you ever find any sense of refuge or safety in the allness of it?
Mm-hmm. In the sound and the vibration and the energy.
Yeah. And the ongoingness of presence, perhaps.
What do you mean by that? Well,
presence is ongoing, even mm-hmm. as we experience ourselves as this sort of, not even ourselves, there's just a dispersed, distributed mm-hmm. mess
yeah.
process, right?
Yeah.
It keeps on going, and it's all
yeah.
right. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Thank you. Thanks. Maybe one more person? Yeah, right behind you. How about that?
I had an interesting physical reaction. I noticed when I drifted off, my body cooled down and I started getting cold. Mm-hmm. And when I brought myself into my body and tried to feel it, then I really hot and I started actually sweating. So it was this back and forth depending on where I was in my body. So this just to share this experience.
Yeah, thank you. That's actually a good segue to what I'd like to talk about for a few minutes here, which is how doing things with our minds can have such an effect, in your case, as you were sharing there, in your body, and also, as I'll talk about in a moment, in your own brain. And it's because the mind and the brain are one unified system. Sidebar, just to use the words clearly, I use the word mind to mean the flow of information through the nervous system, most of which is unconscious. So it's a kind of a wide open and very useful definition of mind, which does not require a self, by the way. So hopefully we won't get too far into that deep end of the pool, but if you just think of it, there's a flow of information. The point is that as the nervous system changes, that's what enables that flow of information, but also as the information moves, as the mind moves, it changes the nervous system, it changes the brain. For example, this is a slide of a meditator. This is their head cut in half. It's as if the person is looking this way. Okay? This is a Tibetan, I think it's Matthieu Ricard. It's a Frenchman, I believe, but he's a Tibetan monk. In any case, it is certainly a Tibetan monk practicing open, boundless compassion meditation. And the part that you see lit up is that sort of orange caterpillar. I think of it as a little campfire almost surrounded by shadows. Is a part of the brain called the anterior or frontal cingulate cortex. And that part of the brain really activates when people are doing focused attention, when they're sustaining their attention to something in a mindful way. In other words, when they're being deliberately mindful. The point is that mental activity, just sustaining mindfulness to boundless compassion, relatively activates a particular part of the brain. Okay? Here's another slide. These are nuns. And it's very interesting to see that these are nuns in prayer. They're, in this case, doing a kind of union with Jesus, you know, Bride of Christ kind of thing. These are Carmelite nuns in, I believe, Montreal or Toronto. And again, in this orientation, the noses are pointed in that direction. It's a slice of the brain. And the point about this slide, and I don't know if the resolution's that clear. First, if you take a look at the upper left-hand slide, you'll see the LACC. That's the left anterior cingulate cortex. It's, again, that same part of the brain activates with focused, deliberate attention. Which also, for me, is a small point interesting in this particular slide, is that you'll see in the upper right-hand two slides, that says caudate left and right. That's a part of the brain that's very activated in reward states. In other words, when things are pleasurable. Now, it lights up when people win a big prize, when their horse wins the Belmont Stakes.
It also lights up, as we'll see later, when people are in love, which is very interesting. And in this particular case, it lights up with this very pleasurable sense of union with Christ. It is a little bit interesting to reflect on the difference in the two practices. You know, the Tibetan monk is doing something that's rewarding and pleasurable, but it's not intensely emotional. It's a kind of boundless compassion, very spacious, boundless compassion. There's some feeling to it, but it's not intense. Whereas the practice that these nuns were doing was deliberately very emotional, very loving, very devotional. And you can see that the reward centers of the brain lit up differentially, which illustrates, again, this main point, which is, as your mind changes, your brain changes. All right? So to go one step further, what that creates is this fantastic opportunity to use your mind, to change your brain, to benefit your whole being, right? And that's going to be a lot a running theme of today. Of all the mental practices that have been studied in terms of their impact on the brain, if you think of all the mental things people can do, yoga, therapy, positive thinking, affirmations, reading Tara's book, Radical Acceptance, which I highly respect, and if you haven't bought a copy, you should. You should buy several copies. Give them to many friends. Anyway, of all those, the one that's been studied the most is meditation. It's kind of cool. And so this is a quick summary of some of the physical effects of repeated mental activity. The idea is that in the classic statement in neuroscience, neurons that fire together wire together. Right? In other words, repeated mental activity builds neural structure. That's the fundamental meaning of the term. You've probably heard neuroplasticity. The point is, for example, if you just recall for a moment, what did you have for breakfast? You know, to recall that, you've got to access some kind of enduring change in your brain. Now, what did you have for breakfast a week ago Thursday? You probably don't remember, because that particular change wasn't very significant, so that it didn't last very long. But repeated mental activity, for better or worse, so this also means traumatic experiences or negative experiences build structure too, the ruminative, negative, anxious, self-critical thoughts we run in the simulator, in the back of the mind, is kind of quietly murmuring away, running these little mini-movies of, why don't I ever get ahead, or something like that. Alas, that's building neural structure, too. Alternately, one of my core teachers, Christina Feldman, says, as the Buddha actually says, she quotes the Buddha, what we rest the mind upon inclines the mind toward. Or what we rest the mind upon, the mind takes the shape of that. Right? Like a cloth laying over an object. What we continually rest our mind upon in terms of mental activity shapes neural structure in enduring ways. This, among other takeaway points, goes to me to something that's been personally very important, which is a kind of real stewardship and attentiveness to what actually moves through the mind. I think of a temple. You know, if we had a temple and, alas, if the temple dog came in and made a mess in the middle of the floor, we'd go, try not to be too judgmental, but we'd remove it, right? Our mind is like our temple. What do we allow to sit on the temple floor and stain it, you know? So by really paying attention to the contents of mind and what we rest our mind upon in all the little moments of daily life, not once a week when we meditate, but all the little moments of daily life, that makes such a huge difference in the enduring structures that we carry with us wherever we go. So as an illustration of that, this is a quick list of some of the physical effects of meditation. It measurably thickens, which is really cool for neuroscience people, like, wow, it's thicker. You know, there are like millions more synapses there. It thickens the cingulate cortex, that little caterpillar blob you saw earlier. That part of the brain, in particular, it thickens the insula. That's a part of the brain that's involved with sensing inside ourselves how we're feeling, but it's also very engaged with empathy, which we'll talk about later. So by doing a meditative practice in which you're mindful to yourself, you're actually building the neural structures that are involved in empathic relatedness with other people. Another nice finding for those of us with accumulating gray hair, is anyone in this room not getting older every day? Okay, good. Just checking.
normally the brain thins out with aging. We lose about 10,000 neurons a day, or 10,000 brain cells, actually. We start with 1.1 trillion, so that's pretty good, right? But we lose about 10,000 a day. Alas, one drink kills about 10,000 neurons. Alcohol works by depriving brain cells of oxygen. That buzz is the feeling of brain cells drowning. So when I realized this, I became a lot more cautious about what I imbibe. But anyway, so it's a normal process to lose, brain cells with aging. The nice thing about meditation is it seems to be protective. And there's some very, very preliminary and interesting suggestive work that's done that spiritual practice, including contemplative practice, seems to have a protective effect in terms of the normal cognitive declines with aging, including perhaps early Alzheimer's. I heard about a study, and I can't locate it, so I hold it with a grain of salt, but I think it's true that some autopsies of people who were long-term meditators found Alzheimer-type plaques in their brain, but there were no effects behaviorally and interpersonally of Alzheimer's because there was some protective effect of long-term contemplative practice. Another effect of meditation is it differentially activates the left frontal cortex, which is associated with positive emotion. Even if you just do an 8-week training and you're a software engineer in some high-tech West Coast company that this study was done in, you actually get a benefit in terms of differential activation left frontal region. It increases the power and reach of very fast gamma wave brain waves. The gamma frequency is 30 to 80 or even 100 times a second. So what that means is that very large swaths of neural real estate start integrating and connecting, which in a sense increases the amount of consciousness present when people are meditating. Decreases cortisol, boosts the immune system. All right, is meditation a good thing? It's a good thing. All right, next slide. Now I just want to talk through kind of quickly some of what might have been happening in your brain during that wonderful guided meditation, which definitely took me out. Tara went through basically five things. And first she talked about setting an intention. And that tends to enlist both top-down prefrontal regions of your brain, which kind of sets an agenda, biases attention, biases emotion in a certain direction. Notice that intention is neutral. Intentions can be positive or negative, right? The Buddha put a lot of focus on ill will. And the heart of ill will is will. It's intention. What is our intention? Is it to help or to hurt? To lift up or to cast down? That's an intention. And so, anyway, that's top down. But also she used a very interesting word, which was sincerity. Part of what happens when we really access our own felt sincerity of intention, we also activate and build bottom-up intentionality. There's been a lot of research lately on how the mind and the body are really intimately connected, how cognition is embodied. What we think of as abstract, disembodied, Descartes' notion of, the mind and the body is separate is really not true at all. For example, I'll give you a fun study. If you hold a pencil in your mouth, like in such a way that you're forced to grin, like this, or you hold it somehow, like this, and you're forced to frown. This study was done in Germany. Somehow it seems really appropriate. I don't know why. But anyway, I lived in Germany for a year. I like Germany. But anyway, if you're forced to grin and or forced to frown, and then you're shown a bunch of cartoons or pictures, some of them are very funny, some of them are sad, or hear stories, some of them are funny stories, some of them are sad stories, your experience and rating of how funny the stories are or happy is really elevated by being forced to smile. Whereas, alternately, your experience of the stories or pictures is really downed if you're forced to frown, right? So the point is, it's embodied. Well, if we activate a bottom-up intention by sitting upright, like one of my teachers, Jack Kornfield, will talk about, like a Buddha, like a king, like a queen. Sukhmani Rinpoche has a wonderful book titled Carefree Dignity. It's a sense of dignity. What that does is it activates the body and it creates a kind of bottom-up intentionality. Okay? Next one, relaxing the body, parasympathetic nervous system. We have a part of our nervous system that regulates changes. It's the autonomic nervous system. It's like a seesaw. That's why I'm putting my hand like this. The sympathetic fight-flight stress response nervous system goes up when we're excited.
But it particularly goes up when we feel threatened or upset. And we are, as we'll talk later, extraordinarily vulnerable to being, to feeling threatened. So if you're upset, sympathetic nervous system activates. Chronic activation of the sympathetic nervous system is really bad for us mentally and emotionally and physically and interpersonally. Alternately, like a seesaw, when the parasympathetic nervous system activates, it downregulates the sympathetic nervous system. It's the so-called rest and digest nervous system. It's our resting state, but we're knocked out of that resting state for survival purposes really easily. So getting really adept at going back to baseline quickly, recovering quickly from a sympathetic activation is a good thing. And one great way to do that is to practice parasympathetic activation. Okay, next one, feeling safer. This is a really crucial one and a very challenging one because, as I said, we did not evolve to, if you think about it in evolution, our forebears, right? Little rat-like creatures running around Jurassic Park, you know, dodging dinosaurs, you know, 100 million years of mammal evolution, longer actually. You know, the ones that were all really chill. Wow. Look at the light on the leaves, man. I'm just feeling so present. They were nailed, you know? The ones that were anxious and irritable and nervous and cranky, they're the ones that passed on their genes. Right? Think about it. We have those circuits alive and well. I'll talk more later with a slide. You know, the reptile brain, you know, the early mammal brain in here. Man, that's alive and well. We are really ready to be threat alert. We have an ongoing vigilance and ongoing anxiety. Well, it's great for passing on genes, right? But it's really hard for coming home to really arrive when you've got a lot of your attention out here with the sentinels at the gates. You know, that's really difficult. It's really interesting that in the Dharma, one of the core instructions is to find a place of seclusion. In other words, safety. And the Buddha in his own the story, at least, let's presume it's true for the moment, he found his own awakening with his back to a tree. The tree had his back. You know, when Mara came to challenge him, the reality or the metaphor of the forces of illusion and ignorance, which were the fundamental root of suffering, when those came to challenge him, they came from the front because the tree had his back. Right? He experienced a sense of relative safety. There's no perfect safety, right? But we can feel safer. And by doing what we can internally to help activate, using our mind to change our brain, a greater relative sense of safety promotes concentration and absorption and presence. Okay. Next to last, I'll do these last two quickly here. Positive emotion. It's really interesting. You know, when I first came to Buddhism, it sounded very dour and like a total downer. You know, I'm a California guy. You probably detected that already. You're like, whoa, bummer, suffering, what a drag, you know? Sit still, life sucks, you know? Really ascetic, ew. And finally I came to realize, reading the Dharma, there are all these references throughout the Dharma to positive emotion. You know, one of the factors of awakening is joy, a rapture, happiness. Two of the five factors that promote meditative absorption are rapture and happiness, or bliss and joy. Positive emotion is really wonderful in terms of its many, many kinds of health benefits. In particular, for concentration and absorption and meditation, it has a particular benefit. I'll describe this kind of quickly. We do a workshop on steadying the mind. We do a lot of this, but kind of quickly here. Basically, the way attention works. You want to know how attention works? It's really cool. It's like, what we are aware of is like, think of it as a little meadow with a gate, right? And so what's in the meadow is what we're aware of. Could be all kinds of stuff. Could be creepy stuff. Could be happy little bouncing squirrels, right? Whatever it is, it's in the meadow. And then when something else comes into awareness, the gate opens. Whoosh, very often what's in the meadow leaves and pew, something new comes in, pew, gate closes, right? That's how awareness works. What makes that gate open or close? That's a really key question, right? If you want to steady your mind, which is central to practice, you get very interested in how do I keep that gate closed, right? How do I work that gate in a skillful way so I can stay present? Even if what I'm keeping in the meadow is presence to whatever comes through the meadow. Right? Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that keeps that gate open or closed. In other words, steady mid-range dopamine keeps it closed. When dopamine drops, the gate opens. When dopamine spikes, the gate opens. All right. So if you're not being very rewarded by what's in the meadow, dopamine drops, new things come in.
If, on the other hand, something comes along that's really potentially very rewarding, the gate opens. Okay? Rewarding including getting away from a threat. All right? Well, what happens when you're really happy? When you're really happy and you're dwelling and abiding in a sense of peacefulness, including very subtle forms of happiness, just tranquility and okayness and presence, and it's all right and it's good, just well-being. High levels of dopamine are near their ceiling, so they can't spike. See? When you're experiencing positive emotion, which I think is the neurological reason why the Buddha really recommended rapture and saturating in bliss as a key to absorption states, is one key to absorption states, but a main key, you're so high with dopamine levels, you can't get a spike, and the gate doesn't open. So you stay focused on the breath, or whatever it is you're focusing on. And then the last one that Tara talked about in passing was absorbing the benefits, defeating the fundamental negativity bias of the brain through evolution that tilts toward the negative by really absorbing and taking in the good of positive experiences. That's probably going to be my next book, Taking in the Good, which is a chapter in the current book, because it's so central to moving through life and defeating the bias of the brain that's like Velcro for negative experiences, you know, and Teflon for positive ones. Now, as backstory, we don't want to get too caught up in the neurology of this. It's interesting. The amount of knowledge about the brain has doubled in the last 20 years. It's an amazingly young science. This is very cutting-edge stuff. You know, there's still a great mystery here, right? We ask, what is a thought? And we don't know. How do you know there's thinking? How do you know you're thinking? How do you know anyone is thinking? Yet we're thinking continually. So we have to keep it, you know, with kind of a grain of salt. Still, the fundamental takeaway point is that there's an emerging body of knowledge that illuminates the hard-won insights on the cushion of thousands of years of contemplative practice, that also extends them, and also of particular value for householders with a deep interest in practice. You wouldn't be here if you were not someone with a deep interest in practice, and there are no monastics in the room, so they're just householders here, including us. How to help householders with busy, active lives really progress in the transformation and uncovering that's the process of awakening. That's the real opportunity here, that we can use our minds to change our brains to benefit our whole being and every other being we touch. So any comments or questions? Just a few minutes? Yeah.
I'm very interested in how to bring this within a family context. I have two children, one 5, one 8, and there is, I'm sure, a lot of age-appropriate lack of self-awareness and real difficulty in, I guess, settling down, particularly my 8-year-old. And it's a source of continual frustration. That's basically why I'm here today, so I can continuously transform myself, so I can be a little bit at peace with whatever is going on. So what, and I've done a little research on neuroscience, it's fascinating. What is there out there for children?
Yeah. Thank you. I work with kids, so I'm a child psychologist, so I have a lot of tremendous feeling for them and love for them. And I should have added in the beginning, my wife and I have 2 kids. They're 21 and 18. And so we survived the process. We actually traveled for 2 weeks together and got along reasonably well, which is actually very well, so it's a really good thing. A couple of things. First that strikes me, first is that there's a range of temperament. There's a natural range. You know, some kids are more like turtles, some are more like jackrabbits. And there's a general range there. And in a hunter-gatherer culture, having temperamental diversity is really useful for evolutionary purposes. Just a quick sidebar, you know, tool-using hominids were here about 2.5 million years ago, maybe 2.7. They had brains about a third our size, but they still were able to make a stone tool. I can't make a stone tool, right? So we've been at it a long time. During that long period, it helped to have temperamental diversity in tribal groups that were bands that interbred, all right? And being spirited, you know, not settling down, not being meditative is really adaptive in a hunter-gatherer culture, right? And I have a lot of compassion for the ways that we jam kids in these tight slots, 8 hours a day of instruction, and then we train them for, 10 hours a day sitting in a cubicle in some corporation. So paying attention to temperament, I think, and diversity is really respectful.
first point, and trying to give kids as many opportunities as possible to be them, be their real self. My theory of parenting is big pasture, real fences. So anyway, the second point is that I think that this notion of taking in the good is really central for children, because particularly if they're more anxious or spirited, they tend to zoom along really quickly before their brain has really had a chance to register positive experience by holding an awareness for 10, 20, 30 seconds. Right? They've moved on to the next thing. Negative experience registers instantly. It's fast-tracked. It has a preferential fast-track memory system. But neutral and certainly positive experience, especially the mildly positive stuff of daily life, doesn't have a preferential system, so it tends to just slide right through. So I do things, for example, along the day to encourage kids to just kind of appreciate what's good and really have it sink in. Not just notice it, but sink it in by dwelling on it just for a few moments. And at the end of the day, when they're willing to put up with a fair amount of parental psychobabble to stay up another 5 minutes, walk them through reflecting on the good things about the day so it really sinks in. That's a second point. Third point, and then we'll move on. It's about mindfulness in education. If you just Google that, mindfulness education, a lot of very neat things are happening here. And I actually just came back from a Mind and Life conference up in New York. And one of the things that was talked about is how the Dalai Lama is going to come here, I think, in October 8th and 9th in D.C., I think, to do a conference for educators. And so there's a lot that's being done at this point, bringing this stuff more and more into the classroom. They often use a different language. Dan Siegel uses the term reflection because even mindfulness sounds too Eastie and something or other. Okay. Thanks. Maybe one more person, then we'll move on. Yeah, in the back.
My question is, when you're in a difficult situation and you're faced with it and your instinct is to respond immediately to it, how can you be there and train your brain not to do that, not to just jump? That's the question.
That's the million-dollar and thermonuclear question, isn't it? Right? In the afternoon, we're really going to talk about emotional reactivity, especially in relationships, which tend to be the primary, engine of reactivity. So if I could, in the interest of time, duck the question for the moment, I'd like to do that. What?
No problem.
Okay, thank you. If only to say, the good news is that there are a lot of really effective things to do. And we'll talk more about them. Okay. And you?
Studies, the impact on the brain that you're talking about, are they for both formal and informal meditation practices? Informal meaning just in our daily lives, trying to come back to presence. And
you mean kind of like everyday mindfulness, mm-hmm. that sort of thing?
Right.
Yeah. The studies vary. Some of them, typically what they are people who have a significant practice. Although in some cases, they're just people who've done, like I said, an 8-week training program. The treatment, if you will, or the activity that's studied is regular time on the cushion. I'm not aware of any particular study, although it might exist, but I'm not aware of it, that's about everyday mindfulness per se. That said, I'm sure that everyday mindfulness has tremendous benefits. I think that that is a very interesting area of research to look more at.
I mean, okay. Most of the studies, they've actually had somebody sit formally and then they're scanning their brain. So it's right after a formal sit, but the presumption when somebody's been sitting for 20 years is they're in trouble if they haven't been integrating it into their daily life. So you can't really tease it out. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So Rick says a lot, the takeaway point, and just to say it again, that how we pay attention internally changes our physical structures, our biochemistry, it changes our emotional experience, it changes how we behave. So that really wonderful question of, okay, when I'm in reactivity, well, when we're sitting, reaction comes up. And how we learn to pay attention to the reaction internally when we're sitting is going to do a lot on how, when we're in vivo with each other, we respond. Does that make sense? If you can sit and feel anger and judgment come up and internally pause and name and be with, you're going to have a lot more momentum in being able to do that with others. And Some of what I love about this research is just showing that far from this kind of self-centered narcissism of, oh, I'll go into a cave and all, you know, everything we're doing in these practices of paying attention internally actually stimulates the parts of the brain that allows us to be more attuned to each other. You cannot separate intimacy with your inner life and intimacy with others. So I just want to kind of reemphasize, because I think this research is so powerful in that direction. So in that spirit, because this is a day on relationship, we're going to be sitting and then bringing our presence into the relational field. And so I'd like to invite you again to put down stuff, you know, notebooks and so on, and just take a moment to, in a formal way, reestablish your sitting posture. Notice for yourself as you come sitting still, just to sit still. Feel the posture. And then, as we did earlier, just sense, okay, the intention. Just may there be some presence, this arriving, this homecoming. Again, as we did earlier, give yourself that gift of letting go a bit. Just see if there's some natural way that the shoulders can loosen, the hands can soften. Chest open. And perhaps a few full breaths. So in some sense, in this arriving, you can invite yourself home. Invite yourself into a quality of being safe and at ease with the life that's here. To relax with the life that's here. Let your senses be awake. So there's a noticing. There's two questions that really guide us into a full presence. And one is, what's happening right here? So just to ask that and sense the felt sense of being right here. The sensations in the body. Maybe if there's a mood that's predominant. The sounds. So there's the inquiry, what's happening? And can I let this be, is the second part. Really say yes, allow. So that in these next moments of silence, just to rest in this presence that's noticing how it is. Receptive, open, interested. With interest, just let yourself notice the quality of presence, embodied, just feeling the life from the inside out. Senses awake. Here, right here. In a few moments, I'm going to ask you to open your eyes if they're closed, but to continue the presence that's here, that the meditation might just shift forms rather than end by, and you can do it now, just by opening the eyes and in the same way that you might receive sounds, just receive the space in the room, the light, the forms. Still feeling yourself right here. Eyes open. Now we're going to continue the practice by taking some time, since this really is a day on relatedness, to meet some folks here. And let me just suggest how it can work. Perhaps maybe if you'd like to, you can feel free to move around some. So you might even right now just stay aware of your body and stand up and just come into standing and be right here. And so what we'd like to invite you to do is to take some moments to greet a few of the people that are around you, but in a particular way. You might want to shake hands or introduce yourself, but mostly this is just a very brief, you know, under a minute. And maybe four people that are in the room that are right standing near where you are, you'll have the chance just to greet, say hello. But to add to that, and again, this isn't some, I think, new agey, soulful, deep, you know, you don't have to lock in. But but just to say, intend to receive, just as the sounds, just as sensation, intend to receive the who's here. So there's some interest, just as we're saying, what's happening inside me? What's happening? Who is this? There's that quality of empathy that takes in. So just to explore a little that quality of consciousness. Again, not more than a minute. And then turn to somebody else. And if you find that there's nobody else right there, it's a nice chance to pause. But meet maybe four people and then come back to your seat in this way. Okay? Please begin. Okay, please take your seats. Thank you. Now, this next piece is actually quite interesting, if you will. Come back into stillness, come sitting in a meditative posture, and check in again. Bringing the attention right here, and notice what it's like for you. Sense your body. Is there aliveness? Is there a buzz? Are you aware of your body? Sense your heart, whatever mood is here. Just notice what it's like. Be aware of your mind, whatever level of activity, busyness. If there's thoughts, the tone, the flavor. aware in a comprehensive way of this movement from sitting still and inward to being with another or others to sitting still again. And just the quality of presence, our lack of presence, without any judgment that might have carried through. Okay, so opening your eyes, coming back, and just to invite anyone who would like to share what you noticed in this practice of internal and then interpersonal meditation. What was it like for you? Anything you noticed?
What I found is that by connecting with the people that were next to me, it gave me the sense of a larger community.
Mm. And what was that like for you? Was that a pleasant experience?
Yeah, it's very pleasant because I'm a very extrovert, and as a Latina, I feel building relationships is so important, so we are not in our own cubicles. So for me, it's very important to get to know people.
Okay, so one response then is that beginning to touch base with another actually allows you to feel part of something larger, and it's pleasant. Others?
I found myself, the longer I was practicing or speaking with others, that I lost my ability to stay present. And it worked in the beginning, but then it stopped.
And what was it like? Were you aware of when it stopped? I mean, was there a present?
Not a moment, but I kept checking in and noticing it was less and less, and that I was less able to kind of feel the presence I had felt in the beginning.
And when it wasn't so there, what was it like?
Well, I'm an extrovert as well, and so I tend to give energy out to people, and I think that is how I felt. I felt that I was more aware of the other people or person than aware of myself, which tends to be my pattern.
But. Good, that's good to notice. So when there wasn't as much presence, that pattern kicked in. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I noticed when I was meditating after the interpersonal interaction that I felt a tingle or a buzz in my head and a fullness in my chest, heart area, and kind of a warmth in my belly. And it felt, and my heart was not pounding, but it was, I was more aware of my heartbeat was beating faster. And it felt really good.
So a pleasant arousal. Yeah.
And prior to that, I think I just felt more stayed. Meditating prior to interacting, I felt more stayed and not a little confused about. I'm newer to meditation. Like, what is this about? How should I be feeling? So that was really interesting.
Yeah, to notice the up level of the energy. Yeah, thank you.
I'm Julie, and I'm an extrovert too. But
funny that the extroverts are sharing.
But I can be an introvert, not very well, but I can. So I noticed that when I met with certain people, it felt like I was exchanging the energy I had with them. It was the way we greeted each other, instead of just talking and saying, you know, good morning or hello or whatever. Some of it was more like that, but there were some where I could actually feel an exchange of energy, and it was really, gave me a warmth, warm feeling.
So more than the words, there was actually an energetic exchange that felt warm.
There may have been less words, actually.
That's right. I meant instead of the words, it was the energetic exchange.
Right.
Yeah, thank you. Okay.
I'm not an extrovert. But I sometimes play one on TV. The basic thing that I found as a comparison between both activities, I was struck by the sense that I was opening in both of those experiences, mm-hmm. that there was an opening. And I had to work at it a little bit more with the outward part. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm better at defending myself from other people than I am defending myself from myself.
You're better at defending yourself.
I'm better at defending myself from other people than I am defending myself from myself.
So you're aware of that you're more aware of how you have, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not an extrovert. I'm more open to going into me than I am to going into somebody else,
yeah.
I guess.
Thank you. So that makes me want to ask a question. How many of you were aware of that to some extent, that with others there was some nervous or shy or defended that you just became aware of just because you were noticing? Because it's completely natural and normal. It doesn't matter if you're an extrovert or an introvert, that's just a natural part of it. I want to just, there's so many things to share about this, but I just want to name a couple of things, because to me, we have a lot more practice formally in paying attention inwardly than we do in paying attention when we're with each other. And it's a sacred and precious life practice to begin to do that, and then notice the conditioning. We all have a tremendous amount of conditioning interpersonally. Whether you look at it in an evolutionary way that we're rigged to look for who might cause us trouble, the tribe that's not us. We have an us them. It's built into the brain to scan that way. And we all have wounding in our own lifetimes of those that misunderstood all the way to abuse. So there is a lot of conditioning to be really careful and wary. And we live in a predicament that's, I like the language of the big squeeze, where on some levels, every day with each person, there's something of what we want, what we don't want, and playing out this conditioning of what I think of as the trance of the separate self. I'm me, and the world out there could be threatening or maybe give me something, but it's different than the us, right? So we have that makes us shy of each other or afraid of each other. And just to name that, we're afraid of each other. And each of us intuits and longs for the belonging that we know is our capacity. So it's that stretch is the intimacy, that we long for intimacy and we're afraid of intimacy. And one of the invitations of today is that it's not wise to feel like we should push ourselves into feeling other than we feel, that we should be able to feel we're all one. That's not wisdom. Wisdom is to bring our presence to where the conditioning plays out. To start to notice, as one person described it, oh, I tend to put out like that. Or if your way is, I tend to go like this. Or I tend to not really say what's true for me. Whatever it is, to bring a real kindness and presence to how our conditioning is with each other. And as we'll explore, and Rick's going to be moving us forward after the break in this way, there's a fundamental attitude that really allow, it's kind of the seed to intimacy with our world, is to don't make yourself wrong for however you are. If you can move through the day, and I like Rick's language of takeaways, and that is to really recognize this is just the conditioning playing out. To really, with a gentleness and a kindness, you know, to let go of the blaming, of the making wrong. One of my favorite teachers' description of this, Charlotte Joko Beck, says that our failure to know joy and to know love and know connection in whatever way is directly related to our incapacity to forgive, to let go of the blame. And it starts inwardly. So if you can not blame yourself for however you are, that's going to free you to engage in a really awake and interesting way with others. So I'd like to leave you with that and know that we're going to take a break. We'll be taking about 15 minutes or so. You'll hear gongs and we'll call you back in. And it's a wonderful time to not be vigilant, but to be interested and curious about presence with each other.